Hi, and welcome to this special edition of International Writers Network. And this is historical for me because we have in studio live, not on Zoom, not on the telephone, we have Sheil Walsh, a wonderful author who has done the remarkable during the pandemic. And we're going to hear all about it now. Sheil Walsh, you're welcome to Studio 3 today, in person.
In person, and still alive as far as I can tell.
You're already an author, and you wrote the book Colour and Flavour, The Only Thing Missing is the You. And that was written in America, inspired by your daughter, motivated by your daughter to get on and write.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, and you gave us some wonderful extract from that particular book. But you've gone on further, and that's where we want to know, that's what we want to talk about today, to really expand on your work in Ireland, because that one was done in America.
Yes.
But since this pandemic, you've produced two things and two books, and I would like us to talk about them.
That's the idea. There's this material for probably four books, but I'm concentrating on two in particular right now. One, because we were all affected by the pandemic, and when we were first locked down, I had the idea to, because I live in Ashford in County Wicklow, so I had the idea to, on as part of my walk around to exercise, that I would write about it and, you know, share nature with people during the pandemic, also with photographs. So a lot of the wildflowers and things that I would see, I didn't know what they were. And I thought to myself, well, there's something to keep you busy for a while. So keep me out of trouble. And so that's what I did. And it ended up, I did it in a total of six parts that spans the year, a whole year, for the seasons. But I mean, when I started out, I thought it would be just for a short period of the spring and the summer, maybe early summer, but it carried on, as we well know. But finally, now we are coming out of it, and that's a great thing.
That's a great thing. I'm going to take you a little bit back now. You said, obviously, the pandemic hit everybody.
Yes.
And a lot of writers got writer's block, couldn't go any further. Some people felt, no, I've just got to sort out this whole health issue first before I could go on writing. But that wasn't for you.
Actually, in actual fact, I would say that if I didn't have that project, my creative impetus was not where it would have been, I think. I did feel, and I had to push myself to do this, which is probably a very good thing, because I did. You know, you don't want to get tied up into something, into being. I mean, a lot of people, I'm sure, were depressed with the pandemic, and so to prevent yourself from getting in that frame of mind, to do a project, to do something that was challenging, very challenging to me, because I had to learn computer skills that I wasn't previously capable of. And I'm not particularly computer friendly, so.
Computer friendly, I'm not
good. Yeah. So it was a labor, but I enjoyed it, actually, and it really challenged me, and I hope other people enjoy it.
Yes, I mean, I've seen some of it, and the ones you sent me is just like brilliant, because I thought, I know the name of that kind of thing.
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, but I want to talk a bit about the book, because what happened is that you were going on your walks every day, which you were told to do some kind of exercise. And that, I said, first of all, it was 2 kg, and then obviously they expanded to 5 and all the rest of it. And you live in Wicklow, so that's a beautiful place to be in anyway.
Yes.
And are you a professional photographer? Because some of the photographs I've seen, obviously they can't see it on the radio, is fabulous.
Well,
the colours.
I didn't go to school to do it. But that's kind of typical of me. I hardly went to school at all. So everything I've done, I sort of had to do, learn as I went along. But I was serious about it. If you're serious about something, you'll find a way to do it. And if you're really serious about it, you'll find a way to do it well.
That's wonderful. That's a good motto. If you're serious about it, you do it really well. And so you had them into seasons. And what about, how did you get to know? I mean, because there were so many flowers you've included there. This is a real nature book, I think. I would suggest to people, if you got this book, they were to go the same walk as you went, take a bed and breakfast, and probably see all those things at those springtime.
I've set up a toll booth at the beginning of it now.
Right.
So that I, you know, people that want to go on that walk have to pay me a toll.
I thought you'd be serious for a moment. That's an Irish humour. I should have got that. But isn't it though? Because you're going through a walk, and people could just walk those way, and
yes,
then you see those things.
Yeah.
So tell us a bit more about how you laid it out, because I think the layout was really inspiring for me.
Yes, well, I just started, you know, section by section. It ended up being a 10-kilometer walk, and how I kept within the letter of the law is that I was never any more than 5 kilometers away from the house, as the crow flies, because it was a circuit, you know, and so. You know, you just fortunately really think I had this wonderland that I didn't appreciate on my doorstep. And so walking around and really seeing what's there and how it changes and how the seasons change and how important it is, you know, for the wildlife, for the different plants to survive. And some even wild plants are endangered because of crop fertilizer and things like that. And also, you know, it amazes me. Just one instance, I won't tell you where it is exactly, but it was one farmer who was obviously a little bit driven, stripped all the hedges down. So for example, and they did it when the elderberries were ripe. So that meant that it deprived the birds in particular of food. And it's that kind of unthinking thing. And I'm sure the person is a nice person, but you know, people just have to be aware what we have to help. We're part of nature. We're not separate. We're part of nature.
It's funny because writers seem to be getting into that and writing that more and more into their stories and their thing. Do you think it's a realization that, hold on, is a pandemic realization that all of a sudden you really thought about what it is that's around you?
Yes.
And little value maybe we had before, and now we need to really think about how we operate within our environment, basically.
Yes. Well, you know, I feel I myself very upset with myself because our language, Irish language, is really a language of nature, and which isn't really surprising because it was always an agricultural community, you know, going back thousands of years, you know, in Mayo, they found fields that were 6,000 years old. You know, there are places in Ireland that 6,000-7,000 years old, where people were living, and they were aware of all the plants, they were aware of all the crops, they were aware of the stars, they were aware of the world.
Right.
In a way that they were attuned with it. And I think this pandemic has made us rethink. And maybe we can become more attuned again.
Right. Well, without a further ado, would you read us one of your extracts there, please?
Well,
obviously we can't see the picture, but I love the way you commented on your pictures to give us an idea. You see this beautiful view, and then you give us a little taste as to what it is we're seeing and what it is. And I thought that was very good. I could certainly take that book to the field and walk 10 kilometers.
Yeah. Anyway, I titled it Confined.
Confined. Why? Why the title?
Because we were confined. I mean, in the very beginning, if you remember, it was 1 mile, one kilometer.
Yeah.
So, and then in a confined space. Routines in disarray. It's time to reinvent, reboot the old hard disk. Luckily, it's spring. Plenty to inspire mental renovation. Fortunate to live in the country. Used to walk to the bus stop. Walking now takes a new and wonderful dimension. Health of mind and body, best of all. Enjoy, embrace Mother Nature face to face. New sense of adventure. Out of the house, turned up the lane, hidden among nettles, unfurling ferns, coy company of bluebells. Then a blackthorn tree in full bloom glistens in the spring sun. Picture after picture presenting themselves, all posing for the good shot. Evolving day by day, week by week. Herb Albert has departed. We still have Herb Robert. Hides among the nettles, docks and dandelions, then climbs walls, vying for attention. White stitchwort everywhere, a gang of them gathered by a meadow's gate. Unassuming blue speedwell rewards a closer look. Ever-present yellow-flowered gorse, accompanied all the way by birdsong. Sweet sparrows, robins, blackbirds, thrush and cooing wild pigeons. Nearby a pheasant's rattle, cry rattles. Primroses quietly sit, then an astonishing beauty, delicately nodding, pink lantern columbine, what a treasure. A shapely silver birch, standing alone beside the ditch, all along the white-flowered garlic, adds its rich scent. Now the conifers jump up the hill, along the border of the newly planted field of maize. All Scotch pines, tall Scotch pines with abundant young cones. Lodgepole's next a friend to Indigenous Americans. Served their teepees best. Hues and yellows, whites, blues, everywhere a sense of nature's opulence. This and more in one mood-altering mile.
I mean, my mood is altered just going through those. That's the first one. That's your first
one. That's one.
That's one. And you have how many of those, Jim?
Six.
Six. They're brilliant. Do you know what I love also is because you made it so they were more human, like posing for attention. I suppose you were seeing it from it with a different eye now.
Oh, yes.
And I think those who would read this will see your eye, will go out there with your eye, but they will see now what you want them to see.
Yeah.
That there's so much out there. And thank you for sharing that. And that at the end, you let us know how we're going to get this book because you're going to get it printed and published.
Well, it has to go through just one little obstacle to get published, which is something I'm working on. But it's complicated. But as soon as if it ever happens, but maybe it'll come to the point of doing something like crowdfunding or something like that.
Right, to get it out. Because I think it's one of these things that even children, it's nature study. It's beautiful.
Speaking of children, when you talk about me, looking at things and see things through my eyes. I think through the eyes of a child is what's wonderful because they're seeing something new that we take for granted. And it's really, I think that's a joyful thing. Think about a child, how a child looks at something and sees it for the first time. I think that's something if you keep in your mind.
Right. Absolutely, absolutely. This, before we go into the second book, because as I said, you've done extremely well during this pandemic. Before we go into your second book, this month we're going to be talking about the storm. Now, there's not a right or wrong answer about that. Just when the word storm comes into your mind, what does it convey to you, that particular word?
Storm. Well, you know, having lived near the sea, storm always puts in my mind, you know, the power of the sea and therefore the power of nature. And it is so impressive. And you realize that we're here more or less at the from the good grace of nature allowing us to be here. Now, other people would say they maybe include God into that, and that's all right, you know, but it can be whoever your God is. Storms. But storms are part of regeneration. You know, if you look at the negative things of storms, yes, in New Orleans, I can't even imagine what it would be like to be a poor person living in New Orleans, because it's the poor areas, of course, that get hit the worst. And there's also they're trying to improve it, but the racial bias there is something else. And so that's a different kind of a storm that obviously has also erupted. So, I mean, you could go on about storms.
But on your way, when you were writing the book Confined, you didn't see any storm because you had brilliant pictures.
There was a snowstorm.
And were you able to capture that on camera?
I was.
Oh, great.
And it lasted one day. So I couldn't believe it. And I woke up one morning and looked out the window and everything is white. And it was just like, oh my God. And I knew it wouldn't last. So I just went out with the camera and it was still slightly snowing. it was just something spectacular. But no, there were other storms. And even storms where I couldn't, that road actually that I was speaking about, the one mile, that road was blocked with flooding. So, storms, they're there, part of nature.
Part of nature, I like that, part of nature. Thank you very much. So on that note, we'd like to come to your second book, which is very dear to you. I think you mentioned it before in the last interview, but now you've actually completed the writing.
Well, when completed, I completed what probably would be volume one, because it's the basic story is about two bears that come to visit Ireland. Because they met an Irish person, and so they're telling the Irish person their story about visiting Ireland, and that's what I'm writing down. It's their story, which gives me a little bit of a broader compass, because the opinions are not necessarily mine.
But they blame it all on the bears.
But they are interested because one of the reasons they are interested in coming to Ireland is because there were bears here in the time that a lot of our monuments are megalithic tombs and in the same period. So they have a connection with that history of Ireland. And so not only that, but they if they can, they like to stay at sites like stone circles and places like that, because the bears are really attuned with the stars. You know, we all know the little bear and the big bear, Ursa Minor and Ursa Major.
Do you know, I've never really studied bear, but obviously I got to know a lot more about them from your book.
Well, it's not a study on bears, but I mean, the reason that these birds have Asperger's. So they're bears with Asperger's. And the backstory is actually that here are two beings who have something that people describe as a disability, but they can do something wonderful, like go somewhere else and travel around the country.
Yeah, they're very clever.
And learn about it. And one of them is a computer whiz. And he learned that because he was captured and lived in a circus. So when he was chained up, some of the artists performing in the circus would leave their laptops around, and he would practice on them.
I must say they were very clever bears.
Oh, extremely, extremely clever bears, both of them.
Now, before we go on, we're coming very closely towards the end, believe
yes,
it or not.
Yes, time goes really quick.
Yeah. Well, before we go on, I was now Asperger's. Do you want to explain to the listeners a little bit about that? Just
yes.
A little bit about that, so we understand why it's so spectacular to have these bears doing what they did.
Well, Asperger syndrome is in the autism spectrum. They're highly functional, and I have a son that was Asperger. That's why my interest in it. And he was very he could do everything. I mean, he drives a car. He has a job. He's social. Now that's not necessarily common to people with Asperger's. Sometimes they're very withdrawn. They won't have eye contact. They don't like to be touched. They don't like people to touch them. I'm only giggling because my son was the exact opposite. And so when I would go to meetings, for example, they'd say, "Is your son have trouble looking people in the eye?" That part he did, but as for touching and hugging, or you know, you had to peel them off people, you know, and and other children wouldn't have that ability. And I don't know whether it was a way, because my idea with him when he was diagnosed, I didn't think I had to put him in cotton wool. I still took him everywhere I went, to restaurants and to because my work was with horses, so it's very flexible, and so he spent a lot of time with me, but he also spent a lot of time with other people. And
so do you think obviously because they're supposed to have a social distance from people because they're not supposed to be that sociable, but you said you actually went ahead and made sure that he had access to all the social things, you know, go out with you and
yes,
and do that. So probably that's the reason why they couldn't see that in his own particular case, because one of the things I was reading is that some people have different stages. And it's maybe very hard to diagnose in some people, but once he's diagnosed, you can see certain traits. So that's amazing that the social part can be lessened if you expose them.
You know, he was always very naive. That's one of their problems. Extremely naive, and in his case, it was in the case that he thought everybody was just a wonderful person. Everybody he met, it didn't matter who it was, and he was not able to read expression.
Right.
So if somebody had an angry face, it didn't affect him. And sometimes that worked well.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you ought to teach, we need to know how to do that.
Sometimes it worked well and sometimes it didn't, you know.
Yes, yes. So with the bear story, you put those characters into the bear.
A little bit.
Yeah. So this is really something we need to know more about to get it.
Yes, and the degrees of it, you know, I think they're only skimming the surface.
Have a quick that piece really quickly because we've really come out of time.
Well, I don't know if we'll have time for this because it's fairly.
Just a little extract.
A little extract.
Maybe just the beginning when they start off their journey.
Well, I was actually going to talk about. I was going to do a little bit of about they were in the burn.
That's fine. That's perfect.
They're talking about to our shelter. The rain had been rainy spells all day, but now it had broken the spell with a deluge. We were just going to enter when Gonzo whispered, "Wait, there's something in there." We peeked in cautiously. Jesus, it's a human, a female of that species. Just then, she spotted us, grabbed up a stick. "Get away from here, you." "Gonzo, what are we going to do?" "Talk to her, you." "Me? Yes, you know, I hate talking to humans." "Hello. Don't be afraid." "What? A talking bear? You are going to eat me." "No, no, no. We are what you call vegetarians." "Yes, vegetarian bears." Then she fainted. The poor thing was as cold as ice. She was wearing the sort of clothes that humans in Florida wear. We had some paper cups, so we gave her some water as she revived, her eyes nearly popping out of her head. "You will not eat me?" "No, really not. We're vegetarian except for fish and eggs." We had placed her between us to warm her up. "Are you sure?" "Yes, yes, do not worry." We could feel that finally she was getting warm. Next thing she fell asleep. "What are we going to do with her?" "I don't know. Better to let her sleep. You stay with her. I will find something that she can eat." She looked starved. She looked pitiful sitting there. She slept the whole night. In the morning, woke with a start. "Oh my God, you are real. I thought it was a dream." "We are real. But there are no bears in Ireland." "Well, it's a long story." "Here, have some bread and eggs. Hope you like them boiled. We would have poached them. We were all out of béarnaise sauce." "What? Boiled. I can't believe it. Talking bears that can light a fire, boil eggs. I know men that can't do that." If I could quickly say, you know, to Harry and the egg slingers, they'd be great. And there's also another group in Bray called Abraxas, and they've also been great. And for other people writing out there to spend the time to find a group to go to if you can. Even if you can't, you can still manage.
Thank you very much for coming on today. We really appreciate you.
Thank you, Mary. It was really a pleasure.
Download a podcast and catch up on your listening at near.ie.
Near FM.
"How's it going, brother?"
"All right, what's up?
Are these guys any good?"
"Dude, these guys are class.
I hear they play the best homegrown music live every Thursday night."
"Yeah, on Near FM 90.3 from 8 till 9.
The Near FM Sessions.
The digital experience. Missed a program or an interview? Catch up now online with the Near FM digital experience. We're online 24 hours a day, podcasting every day. Visit nearfm.ie/podcast.
90.3.
This is Near FM.
Hi, and welcome to the International Writers Network. And as usual, we have wonderful writers coming to grace this platform and to share their work and their journey into writing. And today we have a fantastic guest. It's from the Inkslingers and one of the most famed writers group in Dublin. And they're based in the Irish Writers' Centre. And you're going to be hearing this month some of the people are going to come in, some of the writers are going to come in and share their experience with us. So we're very excited. And to introduce to you, Gerald Byrne. Gerald, I'm really excited to have you here today. How are you doing?
Oh, grand, thank you.
And I don't want to ask a question, but I will ask the question. How did you manage to survive COVID as a writer? Because you obviously are still writing, judging by the things you sent me today.
I went into COVID probably in a more difficult situation than most people, because I had just started minding my mother, who got out of hospital in January last year, and it was either put her in a home or I agreed to look after her in January, and I moved in with her full time to look after her, and I was promised all this help, and what happened was then I got none of it because of COVID. So I was kind of down with a lot of time on my hands to write. And so I spent pretty much, the first 6 months of 2020 just writing loads of stuff I did. Basically, I think one of the things I wrote was a whole book about kind of going into the lockdown and people in Dublin dealing with it in their own way. And then the second one was a kind of a love story set among COVID in a town called Drogheda, where I'm from. And it was just my way of kind of venting my views on the COVID and how people were dealing with it in general.
So you didn't get any writer's block. So we want to thank your mother for that, because...
it gave me so much time down there to work. It did when I was looking after her. I'd be writing first thing in the morning, maybe 4 or 5, because I was suffering with my sleep. And then I'd be writing throughout the whole day. And I came up with a lot of stuff, and I was very happy with a lot of the work that came up. And it was just unfortunate then, near the end of the year, I ended up back in hospital, and I was working on something quite ambitious, and then she ended up dying there on New Year's Eve. So that was extremely unfortunate. But I carried on. Like, she kept telling me to go on with the work, and that, you know, someday, like, you'll make it and things like that. Like, that was the thing she used to keep telling me, even with her dementia and all that. She was still very supportive.
Well, condolences for your mother from me in the station here. And I really, really thank you for still going on, which is, you know, fulfilling that motivation from your mother to go on and continue. And I'm really, really proud, and we all come to a different journey in writing, and this is really very astounding. COVID, mother, death, and you've come up with so many good things as well. So great admiration for you there, and condolences for your mother. And I'm sure you'd be a really good testimony for her once those books are out and selling bestsellers.
You know, so. I was happy to say that I got help trying to publish a few of my short stories and some of her poetry, because she was a poet, and I got them put in a book. But unfortunately, by the time that I was able to show her mine was too far gone. But I did put one of the books in the coffin with her. I did, just as a kind of a gift for the afterlife.
Right, that is really touching, really touching there. So now, just going to try to get your own personal journey. You said your mother was a poet.
Yes.
So how did that affect your writing?
Well, I wanted to be a writer back when I was around 20. And I had dyslexia, and I struggled a lot. And unfortunately, at that time, I felt very held back, and there wasn't kind of much support to be a writer. And I didn't find much support in secondary school, and I kind of gave up on my dream, and I let it slide. But my mother, as a poet wise, she was still writing, but she never really advertised the poems she wrote. And it's only in last year I came across a lot of her work, and that's how that's kind of come about. But as for me, I gave up and just sort of threw myself into normal general labour work, And about 8 years ago, I had an accident that nearly killed me and left me with severe injuries. And it was then that I needed an outlet to help deal with the anxiety and the depression and all the thoughts that were going through my head. And strangely enough, I ended up going back to writing. And it's just grown in the last 8 years that I felt like I've had to train myself how to be a writer without any help. And I've written a hell of a lot of books, but I'd say a lot of them were kind of like training to try and be a good writer. Like, I actually pushed myself to try and do it right on my own. And where I am now, I'm very happy with the material that I do now compared to what I did a couple of years back.
And that is really fascinating. You said you trained yourself. So there was you didn't attend any evening courses, any academic course. You just simply wanted to write. It was a way of expressing things from your heart. Correct me if I'm wrong. Is that really what happened to you? You want to know?
At the start, I was trying to vent stuff at the start, like how I was feeling and the lostness of it all, because I was dealing with, having to take a lot of painkillers, antidepressants, and I had a drink problem on top of it that I was struggling with. And I was trying to get on top of it all, and everything just seemed to be too much pressure. And the only outlet I had was the writing. And the more you write, like, the more you started feeling like you wanted to do it kind of more professionally. So I was testing waters, like, you know, writing in first person, third person, trying new techniques with how you write words if someone's speaking. And then one time I said to myself, I'm no good at writing speech. So I pushed myself to write an entire book that was mostly speech driven, just to test, could I do it? And I did actually pull it off. Like, it came true, and I call it I Can't Swim, Can You? Was the name of the book I wrote.
Fantastic.
It was a training exercise for me to learn how to write dialogue. And now, to be honest, I don't even think twice about writing dialogue. I don't. It just, some people say, like, I've met with people before and they said, oh, you have to go to college, you have to do courses to be a proper writer. I would disagree. I say you can just be a writer just from your own heart.
I think you're right there, because when we're going to hear some of your work, because you did talk about the dialogue, and I especially like The First Christmas and all of them, the dialogue you wrote is really very realistic. Now that you've spoken to us, that you actually wrote a book, so that you trained yourself. Now, that's a lot of discipline. How many days a week did you use to write to get that book done?
Every day. One day, about 10,000 words in a day. I used to push myself very hard and be very strict on myself that I had to come up with 2,000 words every morning. And that was the minimum requirement that I had to do. And it was tough. I don't do that as much now. I kind of took a bit of a break for a while and slowed down because I was pushing myself too hard, kind of burning myself out. But I did try and push hard, and you could come up with a book. If the story was in your head, you could write that book in about 3 weeks. I've done it one time. I wrote a book in 3 weeks, and it was about 70,000 words. Because if it's there in your head and it wants to get out, you will write it as fast as you can before it's gone.
I think you know, the listener's just going to be really fascinated by all this that you're saying now. And also the academias are going to be like, is this spoiling our work? It's going to put us out of business. But you're saying it is that there's a writer inside of you, and that writer wants to get out. That writer has stories that wants to get out. And you need to discipline yourself. This is what I'm hearing from you. Correct me if I'm wrong. Discipline yourself to get that writing out. So were you doing like a 9-to-5? Did you do like a job? Okay, at 9 o'clock, I'm going to start. I finish at 12. I want to get so many thousands of words out. Is that how you did it? Tell us about it, because we want to know about it.
But like, I had sleep deprivation for a long time. Thankfully, it's not as bad now. So I could be up 3-4 in the morning. So what I would do is I'd get up and I would come downstairs, no tally, none. I'd just sit there and I'd write 2,000 words. Because I remember reading one time, I could be totally wrong, that Stephen King once said that he writes 2,000 words a day and that's what you should do. So I remember hearing this and said, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. So that's what I started doing in the mornings, writing 2,000 words before I'd done anything else with my day. And it just stuck with me for a long time. And as I said, I kept doing it up until I actually finished a book that I wrote. I started when my mother was alive, when I was living with her, and I wrote it from October of last year, and I didn't finish till April this year, and it was like 185,000 words, and that was the biggest thing I've ever written in my life. And I think even the fact that I had to finish it because I had started when my mother was still alive, and that motivated me. But after that, I've kind of slowed down a bit this year. I've kind of took a break because I've been pushing myself so many years. I just needed to just slow down a little bit this year.
It's a really fascinating account of your life, but very much needful for us to hear as writers to be. And that kind of discipline is tough, but you know, you're challenging us right now. You're challenging us, those who are listening to you, and there'll be many. Now, how did you get into the writers group? Because you're part of the Ink Slingers.
I basically last January, I needed to something because, as I said, with my mother having the dementia and me going to look after, I needed a day off. And I heard that they'd done this up on a Saturday in Dublin. So I had it all planned out that my wife and my kids would look after my mother and I'd head off to Dublin for a day. And that was like my day out of a break. And I used to just enjoy meeting other people and chatting. And it was an enjoyable little break. And then unfortunately, then it got took away from us by the end of February. So it was all online, and so you just do the writing prompt online and just send in then the story. It is I still can never get used to Zoom. I've always just been more of a person that was great with face to face and meeting people. But I'm trying now to get into Zoom because it looks like that's still going to be part of the future for a good long time.
And what that's fantastic. And what was the benefit of having the first, because you had some months of face to face and then the Zoom part. What was the benefit of those months when you were there and you were going in to Dublin and you were in Irish Writers' Centres and doing the prompt, meeting with people? What was the benefit that you saw?
Well, I'll tell you the benefit now. The benefits would have been, well, first of all, you get to meet fellow people writing and you're kind of talking, and they're talking about their backgrounds and talking about what they like to write and what way they write. And it can be very interesting, like just hearing other people's point of views. Then when you go into the actual room and you're all sitting down and you get a prompt, it's mad with how other people will interpret that prompt and tune it into something different. Now, personally, what I used to like doing with the prompts was I found it was a great way of testing myself to try new things, try a different style, or try something that I'm not a type of character that I couldn't normally be comfortable to write for. That's how I used to use that time. And then afterwards, they'd go for a cup of coffee or maybe a pint, and then everyone would have a chat about their life in general. And it was a nice way of meeting people that had the same interests as you, and you were able to kind of express yourself the way you'd want to be. Because when you're with your normal friends, none of them are into writing or the type of books that you're going to write. And so you can't really get anyone that interested. But when you're up there, you feel like you're part of something that is around the same wavelength.
Right. So that comes, I take you saying that comes highly recommended then.
Oh, yeah, it does. Because they were very supportive during the lockdown. He even released, the guy that runs it, he released a few books that of her short stories. He published them on Amazon, so it was great to see some of our short work actually published.
That's fantastic. Well done. Well, listen, without a further ado, let's get to your first piece and give us a background of that first piece you're going to write to us, and maybe time, just to give, because we want to make sure we get the second part as well, just maybe read about a page and a half from there so we can get a feel for your work, and then the Christmas one, which really is very, I mean, you really elaborate on the good work of dialogue in writing. I thought that is a real credit to you. And we'll read that one last. So let's have the first one, the latest edition.
Testing Times.
Yeah. Do you want to give us a bit of background of that? and then just page?
Testing Times actually has quite a long history. Actually, the character of Jenny the Jealous Junkie goes back to a book I wrote called A Coach Trip. And she was only a small character in it, and I liked her character so much, and another character called Valiant Vicky, that I decided to put them together in a book called The Troubled. And I'm still trying to get The Troubled published. It's about the religious divides in Northern Ireland in modern times, and how two girls kind of overcome it. They do over so many months over the winter. And this was just a short story that I wrote of Jenny the Jealous Junkie, just to kind of put her out there as in the world where people might actually read the short if they won't read the full book. Her heart was pumping hard, but Jenny couldn't slow down or even take a break from her newfound interest in running, mostly down to the two athletic Eastern European security guards that were chasing her through Belfast city centre. Her lungs burned with each shallow breath she took. It wouldn't be long till they caught up with her. Jenny needed to find a place to hide, and fast. She rounded a blind corner, barely missing a woman pushing a pram. Jenny stumbled slightly, but quickly got her balance. Out of the way, she ordered loudly. Jenny spotted a small memorial garden for local Protestants who had died during the Troubles. It had a high metal fence surrounding its perimeter and large, narrow gates that were thankfully open. She ran inside and ducked down behind a nearby wooden bench, which was mostly obscured by a large bush that needed a good trimming. It wasn't long until the two security guards came running by. One of them stopped and glanced around the small garden. There wasn't many places to hide in there, so thankfully it didn't take them long to give up and run off after his colleague. Jenny gave it a few more minutes before getting up from behind the bench. She sat down and took a much-needed rest. Finally getting the chance to examine the spoils of her recent shoplifting adventure, pulling out a large, narrow white box with the words digital pregnancy tests written down the side. Jenny couldn't believe that it had come to this, her future resting on the results of this one test. "You okay, love?" asked an old woman with a bunch of mixed flowers in one hand. She was wrapped up in a heavy blue coat with matching woolly hat, probably in the hope of fighting off the cold autumn air. "Yeah, why?" Jenny was blunt as always. "Sorry, love, just thought you had a million problems on your shoulders." "Well, I don't." Jenny shoved the test back in her jacket pocket. "Sorry to bother you." The old woman shuffled off towards a nearby brass plaque that was sunk into the edge of the path before struggling down onto her knees. She began to lay out the flares across the shiny, well-kept surface. A pang of guilt started to fill Jenny's heart. She preferred to be seen as a stone-faced bitch, but there was times when it was hard to hide her true feelings. "Can I ask you something?" The old woman seemed surprised by the question. "You talking to me there?" Jenny glanced around the empty park. "No one else here." "What do you want to ask me?" "Why are you putting flowers on a memorial plaque and not on the person's grave?" "Because no one knows where my son is buried," the old woman replied wearily. "People keep talking about how great it is, that the fighting is all over, but it never ended for me. My family never got closure. All I ever wanted to know was where my son's body is, but people just want to brush all those questions under the carpet for the sake of the Good Friday Agreement and move on. I can't move on with my life. My son's death destroyed my family, tore it apart at the seams. Now I'm all alone in my grief." The old woman struggled to her feet. "Can you help me up us up there?" That's the first page.
Right. I mean, do you know what? You touch on so many points there. And you're right. The dialogue. You're great at dialogue.
Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. And do you know what? Because the whole issue of, you are very good at dialogue, because I felt the old woman, the loss of her son and not having a closure. I don't even know how many years that is afterward. She's still going there. Thank you very much.
So, thank you. I always just felt that, you know, when it came to stories about the Troubles and things like that, I always felt like it was always sort of maybe one-sided, and I just wanted to write the other sides, like a character from the other side, and show their pain. Do you know what I mean? I did, because like I would be Catholic, but I wanted to try and write a kind of a character, like a Lila's character, that maybe in the book people will look at her at the start and she's like, oh, there's no way this one's going to be likable by the end, and I try and make redemption for her as the book went on. Do you know what I mean? From being a kind of nasty character at the start and become a nice character near the end of it, you know?
So now every month we have a specific topic that we just ask the writers to just give us. There's no right or wrong answer. And this month we're talking about the storm. Storm. What does it mean to you when you hear the word storm as a writer, as Gerald?
Storm. Well, I suppose being from Ireland, I'd just be thinking of the weather because we have such kind of bad weather here, like that. That's the only thing when I think of storm, that would be the one thing that would come to mind, would be that. But I know, as you say, like other people would see it differently, the word, like kind of if there's a storm coming, they do.
And have you ever used stormed in your writing in any form or any shape? Or is it just Irish weather? It's very stormy. You don't know where you are and that's it.
Have I ever used storm in my writing?
Has there been an atmosphere of a stormy atmosphere or anything in any of your writing?
I've used bad weather, like kind of, I use weather a lot in my books. I couldn't honestly say I've used a storm, but I've used bad weather a lot as for different reasons, you know, like when characters like kind of might get hypothermia or things like that. I have used the elements kind of to... when I need them, but I don't think honestly I'd ever actually written a book where I could call it a storm. Like, can I say the time when I wrote something called the Corona Complex, which was my kind of personal feelings on the forced lockdown in Ireland. It was all set in an apartment block in Dublin, and it was kind of the whole idea was like a pressure cooker, which was supposed to be like a storm coming on the horizon. And the whole place just went to hell. It does in the book because they can't cope with the idea of all being trapped in and everything, and it all falls apart. And that was the whole idea, is that the fact that they're all stuck in this building, all these different people with their own tensions and problems, that they all exploded over time.
Right. I would love to hear that too. You sound... Now, this is just off... I'm just going to throw this out there. Are you writing for entertainment or writing for change? What is the purpose of your writing? Are you writing for entertainment? Writing for change? What is the purpose of your particular kind of writing? Because, I mean, when you talked about, you know, whether it's an estate with all these different types of people and how they're coping with the storm, it's very current, very topical. Then before that, we had the one in Belfast, the issue in Belfast, Protestants and Catholics. So are you writing to entertain through your work, or you're writing to make changes? Are you having any, is a political issue? What is your writing really about? What's your aim of your writing?
I like to write things for different reasons. Like when I write something serious, like about Northern Ireland, I feel I want a kind of a more realistic point of view about how both sides are. So I heavily researched it and the history so that aspects of that book were true, and also different things that each side would say about the other or their views. I put a lot of work inside it to try and get it equal. I don't know why. I've always had a kind of a fondness for Northern Ireland and everything, like kind of its beauty and all that. And that topic just kind of meant a lot to me when I wrote that. Like I've written about Northern Ireland, the Troubles, and other parts of my books, but that was the one where it was just fully about Northern Ireland. As for the virus thing, I think because it was there and it was happening, I just sort of got into my head like that I wanted to write something. Like people say, like I remember meeting a writer once and they said, oh, well, I just pitch first and then I write a book. And I'm like, I can't do that. If I want to write something, I'll write whether people will buy it or not. I will just write what's in my head. And if nobody wants it, nobody wants it. Like I do now, if I feel that I need a break, if I write something extremely serious, I can't go and write something extremely serious straight away after because my head needs a break. So I normally write some kind of comedy afterwards. I put like a comedy story between each serious thing I write to kind of break the mood, because you can't keep writing depressing stuff all the time. You have to have something lighthearted to kind of balance it.
That's a good one. That's a good one. That's very interesting. I'm sure writers say, yeah, write that down. When I write serious stuff, put a bit of comedy inside, write something comical, and then go back again to another serious situation. Because I think sometimes as a result of that, you could become very depressed with your own writing if you was not careful. Well,
you want to be able to come back at it. The last thing I wrote there this year, I wrote kind of a book. Now I only wrote the first draft of it. I never went back and finished it. But it was called A Typical Irish Funeral, and I just threw everything at that. Anything bad that could happen at a funeral, I threw it at the funeral, and it was just I had the hearse explode. I had the it was a big row at the funeral, and things like that, and at the afters. It was just supposed to be absolute chaos, and it was just a bit of fun. Sometimes you need that just to clear the head.
Right, I remember that. You need to get all these books. We need to get hold of it. You tell us at the end. But now, just to go back to your dialogue thing, I really would love you to read, and I'm sure the audience will love to hear The First Christmas Without. Is it possible to have that? And we're going to come. We're coming to the end.
I'll read the first page of it then. The gas boiler burst into life with a worrying rattle. Evelyn feared that it was close to packing in after all these years, and the timing couldn't be any worse. Most of our money had gone on the kids' presents this year. It may have been their first Christmas without our husband, Philip, but she wasn't going to let them go without either way. Niamh, Michael, John and Kieran were sitting around the kitchen in their school uniforms. Milk and bits of cereal were splashed around each of them. Normally Evelyn would have lost the head by now, but she was too emotionally drained already. The final demand for electricity was in her hands and she had no money to pay it. "When are you putting up the lights outside, ma'am?" asked her eldest son, Michael. Even for 10, he had a sensible head on his shoulders. "Yeah, ma'am. When are we decorating the house?" Niamh was the youngest of the four, the one that the other three were very protective of, especially in school. Evelyn glanced back down at the very large electric bill in her hands. "We won't be putting them up this year. Your father normally did that sort of stuff." Kieran got up off his chair and hugged into her legs. "Please ring Dad, ma'am. Maybe he'll come and put them up for us. He might even stay for dinner if you ask him." Evelyn wiped the tears from her eyes and kneeled down beside him. "I know you'd love your dad home. So would I, but he's not coming back." "Leave men alone, Kieran." Michael's protective side reared up again. "You know he's not coming back." "But why?" moaned Kieran. "Yeah, why?" Niamh whined. "Because he's not," John angrily cut in before storming out of the kitchen. Evelyn quickly snapped back into her mother role as she rushed out to the hall after him. John was already putting his jacket and runners on. You could see the tears in his eyes. "You want to talk about how you're feeling right now. It's okay to be angry. That's natural." John wiped the tears away with the dirty sleeve of his jumper. "I just don't get it. Don't get it, ma'am. Why did he leave us for Sarah?" Evelyn hugged him close to her. "I don't know, dear. That doesn't matter now." She tried to change the subject with something lighter. "Are you looking forward to Christmas? It's not going to be the same. Can we really not light up the house this year?" His pleading eyes staring up into hers. "We just can't afford it." Evelyn hated to break his little heart, but she had no choice. Soon she had all the kids in school and was now walking back up our street. The cold icy air dug into her body with each step. She couldn't help but admire the set of Christmas lights that covered many of her neighbours' houses, just waiting to be torn down as soon as it got dark. Her house looked bare in comparison. On the bright side, next door to them lived Mr. Foley, an elderly pensioner who didn't bother with anyone on the street. He never put lights up either. He'd given up all that when his wife died. Evelyn had never met her. Mrs. Foley had been long dead before she moved in, and he had never been the most hospitable over the years, keeping to himself if possible.
Wow, I just love those dialogue. Thank you so much for coming in. Thank you for all the wonderful advice you've given today.
Shiny and sparkly and splendidly bright, here one day, good one night.